Welcome to Amandla. This week it's a rebroadcast from previous editions of Amandla. The first that you'll be hearing tonight is from July 17th, 2019, and it's called Shining the International Spotlight on Barrick Gold and Crimes Committed at its North Mara Mine in Tanzania. Gwen interviewed Catherine Cummins from Mining Watch Canada about the situation of Barrick with relationship to many of the abuses and atrocities that had occurred at that mine.
Good evening and welcome back to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM. And I would like to remind you about our blog where we post the best of Amandla, which is ckut.ca/Amandla. We've covered the egregious situation at North Mara Mine in Tanzania for over a decade here on Amandla. Why? Because it's a distillation of corporate impunity and brings in Canadian mining giant Barrick Gold in an intimate relationship with state violence in Tanzania in the name of profit. Yesterday, much came to light about the crimes in North Mara in a wave of reports in media around the world. Joining us tonight from Ottawa is Catherine Cummins, Research Coordinator at Mining Watch Canada. Catherine, welcome back to Amandla, and welcome back from your recent trip to Tanzania.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy that we're getting the great exposure we're getting.
It's amazing, and we will definitely talk about that tonight. Such a joy to see something like this covered, not just here on our wee little show Amandla, but in a lot of really mainstream media. So it is, it's an important moment. But let's talk about this coming out of an initiative called Forbidden Stories. What is that?
Yeah, this is really interesting. About a month ago, we were contacted by a journalist actually in France, and he explained that they were putting together a consortium. So this was put together as a consortium of journalists from different countries right from the beginning. And this is part of a series that they're doing. It's called Forbidden Stories, as you said, mm-hmm. and there is a website. If people Google Forbidden Stories, you'll see sort of what the focus is. And the focus is really on abuses happening around the world, somewhat focused on the environment, but also definitely on human rights, mm-hmm. that are not getting out, you know, that are just not hitting mainstream media or local media because of the threats to journalists who are trying to cover these stories. And so a good part of the reporting is on the threats that journalists in Tanzania have faced over many, many years now, different you know, governments that have been in place when they've tried to report on the abuses at, in North Mara. And so,
well, let's start with that. Let's start with the, then let's just dive right into what they found, and let's start with those journalists. What's been the experience of people who are trying to expose what's going on at the, in that mine and the surrounding community?
This. Yeah, we've actually known this for a while because we've been in touch with Tundulisu, who, when we first started Mining Watch in 1999, he was an environmental lawyer with an NGO that focused on environmental law in Tanzania, LEAT.
Yeah, he was also a contributor here. We spoke to him several times here here at Amandla, and he sat in my very kitchen while we talked about everything that was going on in Bulyanhulu. Bulyanhulu, exactly.
Yes. So, yes, so that's what the issue
goes way back.
To us. Oh,
yeah,
my goodness. Well, that is amazing that you've got that history. So, yes, when we first started Mining Watch, he came to us and said, look, there's this terrible story. Mm-hmm. Another Barrick mine, so there's three mines owned by Barrick, indirectly through what was then African Barrick Gold and is now Acacia.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bulyanhulu mine, huge human rights abuses, and he was very involved in that, and he was very threatened around that story.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been involved in North Mara as well, and so, you know, he wasn't a journalist, he was a lawyer, but he has since been elected as a member of parliament for the opposition party, mm-hmm. and has continued speaking out about these abuses, and was badly shot up last year, something like 16 bullets. It's amazing he survived. He's not in Tanzania anymore because he remains threatened, but he has really tried hard to get this story out. And one of the things that, you know, he's done, obviously, is worked with journalists in Tanzania and, you know, brought the facts and the data to them and tried to bring them to the story. And large numbers of journalists in Tanzania themselves have been threatened for trying to tell this story. We also know, like, before I went there for the first time in 2014, so I've been going yearly, and my last trip was in May, we were told to be very, very careful because there was a Canadian journalist that had been thrown out of the country, had been deported for trying to report on this issue. And we were told to be careful, to make sure that we went in with business visas so that, you know, if we went in with tourist visas and then we were doing this human rights research, we could, you know, rightfully, I guess, be accused of not having gotten the right visa. So we always went in with business visas and made sure that, you know, if anyone stopped us and asked us what we were doing, we could show that we were doing the work we're meant to be doing as Mining Watch. So we were aware right from the start that this was a story that people were having a hard time reporting on. And, you know, we ourselves, of course, have been reporting. After every field trip, we would document the abuses. We would, you know, put the abuses, you know, put that all into public reports. This was in the beginning. Mining Watch was going in together with a UK-based organization, RAID UK. And we would put out these reports, but very little media was picking this up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were always grateful to Amandla for covering this, but very little mainstream media was picking this up. So this consortium was really important because they decided to break that silence and go in. And they went in numerous times over the course of a month, and they gathered as much data as they could. And they really took our work a step further because they both went into more detail on the history of, you know, the smothering of this story, but also into the supply chain of what happens to the gold. And that's something we'd never really looked at. We've been focused on the local abuses.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And we'll get to that. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Oh my gosh, there's so much to talk about. I have to throw in an anecdote about Tundulisu when he was here in Canada all those years ago, trying to lay bare the crimes that had happened in Bulyanhulu with, you know, the claim that dozens of artisanal miners had basically been bulldozed into the earth and into their early graves to clear the way for Barrick Mines, and he came with Barrick Gold, and he came with affidavits and was trying to mobilize, you know, I gather with you and also with us here at Amandla and Broadbent Center and a whole bunch of us to try to bring this to light. And then what did Barrick Gold do? in terms of repression here in Canada, did an access to information claim and really shut down a lot of people, seized emails and seized, you know, personal correspondence in a way to snuff out that story. And I would have to say they were successful because it died right there.
You're very right. And we sent a delegate, like Tundu again, you know, encouraged Mining Watch. And we were very new at the time, but to put together a high-level delegation to go and visit the mine. And Joan Kuyak, who was then at Mining Watch, was part of that delegation. And they were stopped. They never even got to the mine. They were stopped on the road to the mine. So, there's you know, not just the North Mara mine, but Bulyanhulu before. There's been just, it's been really difficult to get the truth out about what's going on at these mines.
And then, of course, them carrying out these slap suits that further muzzled any kind of attempt to bring this to light. But let's move it back to the latest news now, because now, you know, that's the history, which is very important to remember. But here we are now, and there's this consortium of journalists. So just very briefly, who are some of them? Let's just give our listeners an idea of what this media landscape is that is suddenly exposing all of this.
I'm still finding new covers of the story in different media outlets, but I know for sure that it's been covered by the Toronto Star in Canada. Mm-hmm. It's been covered by the Guardian in the UK. It's been covered by a Swiss a news outlet, a newspaper. Unfortunately, it's in German because it's actually one of the most extensive stories. It's in the Tagesanzeiger.
So I took a look at it and I thought, I'm not getting anywhere with that.
So if you have any of your listeners,
there was no time to translate.
Can read German, please go to the Tagesanzeiger, because it's actually one of the most elaborate stories. And I did talk to that journalist quite a bit, as well as the one from the Guardian. And it's in Le Monde, so that I think is maybe useful to some of your listeners, because that's a French francophone version. So, and then I've seen it pop up in a Swedish newspaper. Mm. So I think now it's just being covered.
Yeah.
But what I found really interesting was some of the mining journals are now picking it up.
Wow.
And so, you can find that mining journals are saying, oh, no, this is really terrible. You know, this company's having so many problems already in Tanzania because they're also being accused of corruption and tax evasion by the Tanzanian government. And so, you know, one of the mining journals said, this is terrible. They called it a human rights brouhaha.
How condescending is that?
Yeah, and basically said this is the last thing the company needs. And I just think to myself, my God, you know, this is not the last thing the company needs. Like, this is what the people, it's not the company that's suffering here. It's the people, you know, and the focus is on, oh dear, the poor company's in trouble now, you know?
Well, let's talk about the people, because that's just absolutely incredible. So in these reports, let's just remind our listeners of what the people of North Mara have had to contend with all this time with the North Mara mine.
Yeah. And so, the reporting on the abuses is both environmental and human rights, and so I'm also very grateful to the journalists for covering the environmental side, because that's also something we have not been able to do, other than sort of tangentially. We've really focused on the human rights, so I'll cover, you know, what we've been talking about first. And so, yeah, there have been reports, you know, even sort of anecdotally and not sort of in a great journalistic way, the way this is being done now, that there have been serious abuses, assaults by the mine security forces, which are both private security that the company hires themselves, and then the police, which are Tanzanian police, which are part of the security of the mine through a memorandum of agreement that the mine has struck with the Tanzanian police forces. And so, you know, they have armed police who are supposed to be servants of the people of Tanzania, actually working for a private investor, a foreign investor. And they're armed and they shoot. And so there have been, you know, constant reports coming out of people being shot to death at the mine. And then when we went there in 2014 to try and start to, do our own investigations on all of this, we were overwhelmed by the numbers, and we still have not covered, you know, even a fraction of all the people that have been shot and either killed, so we're talking to family members, or we're talking to people who've lost limbs or eyes. Some are shot by live ammunition. Some are shot by what they call rubber bullets, but those can also be extremely damaging. Many, many people who've just been beaten to within an inch of their lives. The police and the private security often have what they call hoe handles, which are these really heavy wooden sticks, mm-hmm. and they just beat people, often around the head. And so we've seen lots of people with serious brain injuries, and then also they beat their limbs, but particularly at the joints, so like ankles and knees and elbows, and people who are just maimed by these beatings, if they survive them at all. And then, of course, we started interviewing women who'd been raped and gang raped by the mine security. And you sort of ask, okay, well, what's going on here? Is the mine security going into the villages? Well, that actually does happen as well. They will sometimes literally go after people in their homes. But more often what's happening is that people who live around the mine, and, you know, we've talked about this before, so I won't go into too much detail, but, you know, they've become desperately poor as a result of this mine taking over so much of the land. But also, these people used to be cattle herders and farmers, but also would have access to the gold, which is very near the surface. And so they were all small-scale miners as well, and that allowed them to make a living, sort of eke out a living in a very dry area. But the mine took over all that land, so even the cattle herding, the farming has become very difficult, and they've lost access to what used to be their gold. Yeah. And so what they're doing is they're going into the waste dumps of the mine. Like, most of the people who we've interviewed who've been harmed were harmed in the waste dumps of the mine. Yeah. So this is huge mountains of rock that contains still a little bit of residual gold that the mine has decided is not worth processing, but that the people can find. And they go in, and this is men, women, and children. Like, yeah. I have pictures of whole families in the waste dumps. And most of these waste dumps are outside of the actual wall that the mine has put up. But then, of course, there are also some, and that tends to be young men, who will try to go over the wall and into the areas, you know, the pit or the processing area where they can find, you know, entire rocks with the most gold in them. And in all of these areas, whether it's the waste dumps or the actual pit area, these people become very vulnerable to attack by the mine security.
And they're so pejoratively referred to as scavengers, which is just such a dehumanizing term for people. It's such a desperate situation. And we've talked about this before, but I'm going to ask you the question again. Why is it a threat to Barrick Gold that locals are going into what has been scrapped and deemed not commercially profitable to try to find those specks of gold? Why is there so much repression around these, what's been dumped by Barrick Gold?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And it's so hard to understand. And, you know, like I said, the women who were raped and gang raped, those were all people who were in the waste dumps, not in the pit. And those crimes were crimes of opportunity. Because the guards are there, they're guarding the pit and the you know, the processing areas within the mine. But they see these people and, you know, the women in particular, those are literally crimes of opportunity. They go after them because they can, because they're officially, once they're in the waste dumps, they are trespassing. They're trespassers.
Yeah. So even the garbage is Barrick Gold's property.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And so they're trespassing. And so that, you know, lends the thinnest of authority. But, you know, clearly the result of trespassing should not be rape or shootings, often in the back, or these severe beatings. If they were going to act as police, they should be arresting these people. And it's not just the police. It's also Barrick's private security. And one of the most shocking things in the interviews that keeps coming up over and over again, whether people are in the waste rock dumps or whether they've actually gone over the wall, very often they get access through bribing the police and the security to look the other way. Mm-hmm. So they have to pay them and then they agree to let them go ahead. But often these stories take a turn when, you know, so I'll ask the interview, you know, as I'm interviewing, I'll say, well, wait a minute, you bribed them and they allowed you in, then why did they shoot you, or why did they beat you up, or, you know, or why did they use gas canisters and, you know, or rubber bullets on you? And they would say, well, it changed when the white man came. Mm-hmm. And it's always the white, you know, I just think this is so amazing how they always say when the white man came. And I say, well, who's the white man? And they don't know. But they said there's two of them, and they're the head of security at the mm-hmm. mine. And when they show up, that's when the guards, whether they're armed, you know, the police or the private security, then start taking action against the people mm-hmm. who they've just let in. Because clearly, you know, the hearing this story over and over again, it's quite clear that the head of security, who's a white person, is seen to want this action. I mean, yeah. why else do it, yeah. right? Like, yeah. if they have been told you should not be abusing people's human rights, you should not be using excess use of force, you should not be assaulting people, then when the white man comes, they would make sure they don't do that. But in fact, when the white man
it's
comes
the opposite.
Is when they... Exactly.
Yeah. yeah. Well, you know what's so amazing is that, you know, Mining Watch, you and Mining Watch have been so courageously reporting this for so long, but now what we're seeing, I mean, I read this in The Guardian today.
Yeah.
It's hit mainstream press yeah. coverage, which is yeah. a remarkable thing. So let's shift to, you had brought it up early on in our conversation about one thing that was interesting that some of these reporters have done is looked at the supply chain and kind of where this gold is ending up. And something that was of particular interest to me is Apple and Canon and Nokia kind of boasting that the gold components in their products are ethically sourced. And yet, what we saw yesterday in this rollout of reporting is that their findings tell a very different story.
Exactly. I was so thrilled when I was contacted by the journalist for the Tagesanzeiger in Switzerland, and he was involved specifically to look at the supply chain and see where is this gold going. And they found out that it's going through a company that's based actually in the Netherlands and in India. But then eventually that gold makes its way to Switzerland, mm-hmm. where it's processed in the refineries in Switzerland, and it sort of gets this stamp of approval mm-hmm. as being clean gold. And of course, this is a very dicey system, and there isn't, you know, there's good information in the reporting that's been done, but I think more needs to be looked at in terms of this, because there's almost like a certification system in place so that the big electronics firms and others that need to source gold for whatever, you know, purposes they use it, can sort of tell their consumers, oh, you know, we do due diligence. We make sure that the gold that we use is not from mm-hmm. from, well, just like with blood diamonds, it's not from blood mines or blood gold mines. But in fact, that it sounds like from the reporting that's been done that these certification systems are basically all in house. So.
Yeah.
They're just the industry policing itself, if you want to even call it policing. And you hear the people involved in these certification systems in these stories say things like, well, you know, it's really hard to know where it comes from, and we do our best. And they had seen the reports that Mining Watch was putting out, because they talk about the fact is, yes, we take these NGO reports very seriously. Mm-hmm. No one ever reached out to us.
Yeah.
None of these so-called certifiers or people who are supposed to monitor the due diligence mm-hmm. of the refineries ever reached out to us to say, hey, we've been seeing your reports. This is of concern to us. No. They talked to the company. They reached out to the company and said, hey, what about these reports?
Yeah,
and the
so
company
it's like a
said,
closed loop.
Don't worry about it,
yeah.
right? We've got this under control. Oh, this is all in the past. And they were saying, oh, we have this grievance mechanism, which we've also talked about how mm-hmm. that really is not working at all. And then the so-called certifiers just sort of go, oh, okay, well, we talked to the company and everything's fine.
Yeah. So now, now with Forbidden Stories, they have really broken this open. Like they've just come out and said, we did the research, we've looked at the supply chain, and your certification is, you know, on very, very thin ice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, you know, Barrick Gold has always kind of been a Goliath of impunity, as we discussed, in Tanzania, in Papua New Guinea, in Canada, and elsewhere in the world. Do you think they're at all nervous now that 40 journalists are covering this around the world and in, again, the mainstream press?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was so disheartened there's only a few places where they actually, so they sent the story to Barrick and Acacia before it was published. And Mark Bristow, who's the new CEO at mm-hmm. Barrick, he just went through his first annual general meeting this past May. is responding, and he's both responding saying that they refute the reports that Mining Watch has been putting out. So, you know, I don't know how he can just say we refute those reports when, you know, they themselves are putting in place a grievance mechanism and processing hundreds of these people who've been damaged or have lost loved ones. So that is kind of disconcerting. But he also made a comment about this being in the past and about them dealing with it. Mm-hmm. And it's not in the past. You know, this is ongoing. And so I'm really disconcerted to hear that they are just taking this deny attitude as opposed to speaking about why it is that they have this arrangement with the police and why it is that these offenses continue and why it is that their grievance mechanism is so appalling that people are having to, again, seek ways to take legal action, which is happening. You know, there's an attempt to take this to court in the UK where the subsidiary Acacia is housed. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's an attempt again at legal action, but this is the second round, right? Yeah. So there was legal action between 2013 and 2015, and a very small number of people did get an out-of-court settlement, but the reason it wasn't a much larger number is because the company put in place its first so-called grievance mechanism and pulled people away from the lawsuit, literally went after the clients of the lawsuit and said, oh, just drop your lawsuit, sign this paper, drop your lawsuit, we'll give you some remedy and sign this legal waiver. So, you know, this remedy mechanism at the mine has been used very nefariously for a long time, and even though they've now stopped having people sign legal waivers, they're still signing a document that says the mine was not responsible for the harm they endured.
Yeah, which brings, the whole thing to a screeching halt.
Yeah, it's very problematic.
Yeah. Okay, well, you just got back from there, so I just want to ask about what you saw on the ground. Have you seen any change? What were your kind of key observations while you were there?
Well, while I was there, this time I was very focused on the remedy mechanism because they keep evolving it, and so they're bringing in villagers now to be part of this final appeal. So I was interviewing some of those, but at the same time, while I was on the ground, I was also being told of very recent shootings again. You know, incidents of violence. Some of them, I think, are in the not all of the. Coverage is the same from country to country or from place to place, but I think in the Guardian coverage...
Yeah, they mentioned it, yeah.
They mentioned that there's been recent shootings. You know, there was one incident, it's just really a dramatic incident of a child that was run over by a vehicle outside of the mine, just on a public road, and this child was run over, and as villagers gathered around this child... The mine security showed up and started shooting people, you know, just shooting them because they were trying to disperse them. There were a lot of people shot. So, you know, this level of sort of impunity and resorting to very violent means of dealing with human situations has not changed from what we can see at all.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's end with this, which is also a subject you and I have visited over the last little while that seems to be going absolutely nowhere, but maybe you will surprise us tonight, and that is the Canadian ombudsperson who is supposed to be bringing Canadian mining corporations to some level of accountability. What do we have an ombudsperson?
Oh, my goodness. This is such a dramatic and terrible story. Like, I was actually hoping to be able to bring this issue to a Canadian ombudsperson, particularly for the victims who are what they call timed out, who have no chance of legal recourse because their statute of limitations in Tanzania is 3 years. Mm-hmm. And there's so many victims that will not be able to go to court. And so I was hoping that we could take this to the Canadian ombudsperson. The office was announced a year ago in January in 2018. With the announcement, there was a commitment from the government, an absolute commitment that was on the website even of the government, that this ombudsperson would have the powers to compel documents and witnesses, which is critical to the ombudsperson being able to do credible investigations and then be able to report out publicly on findings of fact. And that could then lead to a recommendation of remedy for people. the government has totally reneged on that promise. They finally appointed a person, so there is someone now who has been appointed. Her name is Sherry Meyerhofer. She has no serious background in human rights. She was a corporate lawyer for the oil and gas industry in her early career, and she then moved into primarily development work. She was appointed in April of this year, and with her appointment came the what they call the Ordering Council mandate, which is basically describes what her mandate is. And in that mandate, there was nothing about compelling documents and witnesses.
Wow.
It was super weak. It looked very similar to the mandate that something else that the Harper government had put in place instead of an ombudsperson called a CSR counselor. The two ordering council mandates look almost the same. And we have been fighting, we, Mining Watch, together with the Canadian Network on Corporate Accountability, have been fighting, and you know, right up till today, we are still fighting the government to say, you have to live up to your commitment. You made a commitment that this office would be able to compel documents and witnesses. And the Mining Association of Canada, the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, and the Council, the Chamber of Commerce, have already done an op-ed, a joint op-ed, with a little victory dance saying, well, no, we're very, very happy with this appointment, and we're very, very happy with the Ordering Council mandate, and we think it should stay just the way it is, and we're, of course, they're happy with it. You know, the industry has kowtowed to their industry lobby. You know, the government has kowtowed to the industry lobby, which said, you know, make this mandate as weak as possible, and they made it as weak as possible.
And so I gather you haven't gotten a call from her to get the lay of the land.
We have met with her.
Oh, you have?
We met with her, yep. We met with her just before my last bout of travel. And when we met with her, she told us that she has been clear with the government. In fact, she was about to go into a meeting but she was appointed as a civil servant. You know, this is part of the problem. She has no independence.
Yeah.
She was appointed as a civil servant, and her title in the Ordering Council mandate is advisor to the minister. Mm-hmm. So she has no independence, and she was about to go into a meeting with people from Foreign Affairs, from Global Affairs Canada, to discuss the weaknesses in her OIC. We went over them together with her, and she acknowledged that these were weaknesses, and she said that she would really prefer to have those powers. But, you know, she needs to be fighting for that.
Yeah.
And she needs to fight for that, because this is her reputation and her job that's on the line. And honestly, I don't think this is a job she should even want to have if she doesn't get those powers.
Yeah.
And it's looking really bad right now, I have to say. Like, it's not looking like she's going to get those powers. And if she doesn't, I don't know why she would want that job, because she will be a lame duck and she will be miserable, and we're going to be very miserable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a big disappointment, huge disappointment. Again, right? Again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Catherine, as usual, I feel like we could talk all night, and we've only covered part of it, but we were going to have to say goodbye. But before I do that, I really want to congratulate you and Mining Watch, because you have played such a key role on keeping this issue alive. And frankly, I cannot imagine, this whole media initiative, Forbidden Stories, really being able to take off without the kind of work that Mining Watch has done. And I know here at Amandla, we feel so indebted to you, and I'm sure those journalists do, and I do as well. And I want to thank you. Your work is so important.
Well, likewise. And, you know, we're celebrating journalists today, but, you know, you're part of that, right? Mm. You've been getting the story out when no one else was. So really, really appreciate the work that you do as well.
Okay. Well, to be continued.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Maintenant, on va retransmettre une interview faite le 18 mars 2019. C'est de l'interview avec le réalisateur Hassan Mazin sur la présentation, la première au Canada, de sa film Fans, Fanon, hier et aujourd'hui. L'interview avec réalisateur Hassan Mazin.
Bonjour à tous, vous êtes sur Amandla, votre émission de radio consacrée à l'actualité panafricaine que vous pouvez syntoniser tous les mercredis de 19h à 20h sur les ondes de CKUT au 90.3 FM et retrouver nos émissions précédentes sur notre blog au www.ckut.ca/Amandla. Aujourd'hui, pour la partie en français, nous avons avec nous en studio le réalisateur Hassan Mezine. Bonjour Hassan.
Bonjour.
Donc merci d'avoir accepté notre invitation. Alors, nous allons parler avec vous de votre documentaire intitulé « Fanon, hier et aujourd'hui ». Documentaire qui sera diffusé en première canadienne le mardi prochain, donc le mardi 21 mai 2019 à 18h30 ici à Montréal, à l'espace Osgang Plaza. Donc, c'est au 6524 rue Saint-Hubert et c'est un événement qui est co-organisé par les collectifs pour une dignité politique et Lecture radicale Montréal. Donc, pour nos auditeurs et auditrices qui se demandent qui est Fanon, donc Frantz Fanon, un petit rappel rapidement. Frantz Fanon est né en 1925 à Fort-de-France en Martinique. C'est un militant anticolonialiste, psychiatre de profession. Il est connu et reconnu mondialement pour ses livres « Peau noire, masque blanc » et « Les damnés de la terre ». Réputé pour ses idées révolutionnaires et anticolonialistes, il s'est engagé auprès du peuple algérien dans sa guerre de libération, mais aussi auprès d'autres peuples africains dans leur lutte pour l'émancipation et contre le colonialisme. Fanon meurt en 1961 à l'âge de 36 ans et il a marqué de par son combat et ses écrits toute une génération de militants. Alors, c'est de ce parcours-là et de cet héritage dont nous allons parler aujourd'hui et qui fait l'objet de votre film Hassan Mezine. Donc, en guise d'introduction, Hassan, pouvez-vous nous parler un peu de la généalogie du projet ? Qu'est-ce qui vous a poussé à réaliser un documentaire sur Frantz Fanon plus de 50 ans après sa mort ?
Pour la genèse de l'histoire, c'est une rencontre qui s'est faite avec un ami avec qui, lors d'une rencontre, j'avais évoqué l'idée de faire un film sur Fanon. Ça m'intéressait beaucoup, mais c'était juste une idée parce que c'est un gros projet en fait. On ne sait pas comment se lancer dedans au départ. Et cet ami, au bout d'un moment, m'a dit bah, « Tiens, j'ai une interview de quelqu'un qui a connu Fanon ». Et en fait, cette interview que j'avais faite dans le cadre d'un travail sur l'Algérie, où à un moment, il a évoqué sa rencontre avec Fanon, il en a parlé, et il dit, bon, je ne l'ai jamais utilisé, je ne sais pas quoi en faire. Il dit, bah, tiens, je te la donne, fais ce que tu veux avec. Donc l'idée est partie un peu de là, et ensuite, ça a été d'essayer de rencontrer d'autres personnes qui ont connu Fanon, donc d'en faire une espèce de biographie au travers de personnages qui l'ont connu, donc dans différents contextes, bien sûr. Donc c'est parti de là, ça a été un petit film qui s'est fait de 25 minutes, qui avait été présenté à l'époque en fin 2015. C'était un petit film de moins de 25 minutes qui était assez mal fait, j'avoue, parce qu'il y avait beaucoup d'erreurs techniques, il y avait même quelques petites des erreurs, des coquilles historiques aussi. Et donc après, l'idée, c'était de développer un peu ce film, d'en faire un film un peu plus long, parce qu'il y a eu beaucoup d'encouragement de personnes qui ont vu le film, qui avait été présenté dans des rencontres qui avaient été faites pour le 90e anniversaire de la mort de Fanon par la Fondation Fanon à Paris. Et du coup, voilà, donc il y a eu beaucoup d'encouragement. Et du coup, moi, je suis parti dans ce sens de rallonger un peu l'histoire du film.
Okay.
Et en travaillant en ce sens-là, en réfléchissant, au bout d'un moment, je me suis rendu compte que moi-même, j'étais en train de me piéger parce que j'enfermais Fanon dans le passé. Et donc là, il y a eu une petite période de réflexion, et une petite période de recherche, en fait. C'est-à-dire comment le ramener dans le présent et finalement, retrouver un peu des héritiers de Fanon. Mmh. Et essayer de...
Ok. Mais pour parler peut-être un peu plus justement de la première partie du documentaire, vous parliez un peu de toutes ces entrevues que vous avez réalisées. Cette première partie est très fournie en témoignages de proches et de camarades qui l'ont côtoyé. Et on découvre à travers cette première partie du documentaire un homme un peu aux multiples facettes. On voit un Frantz Fanon qui est parfois difficile à cerner de par son parcours assez atypique. Et j'aurais voulu avoir votre opinion, en tout cas, est-ce que vous pouvez, pour nos auditeurs, nous dire un mot sur ce parcours et qu'est-ce qui le caractérise dans les grandes lignes ?
Ce qu'il caractérise dans les grandes lignes, moi d'après les témoignages que j'ai eus, en fait, à chaque fois, les personnes qui l'ont connu étaient pleines d'admiration, en fait. Et je pense pour son côté très humain. Alors, c'est vrai qu'il avait différents aspects, parce que pour les gens qui ont travaillé avec lui, souvent on entend dire que Fanon était très strict, voire méchant. Et en fait, non, il était juste rigoureux. C'est-à-dire que Fanon, par exemple, en tant que médecin, c'est quelqu'un qui avait énormément d'empathie pour les patients. Et ils ne voulaient pas que des professionnels de la santé se comportent mal avec des patients. Parce que les patients n'étaient pas des gens qu'on traitait tout simplement comme ça. Il avait, oui, il avait de l'amour pour les gens qu'il traitait. Donc, il avait cette rigueur dans le travail. Je sais qu'il a, il a envoyé plusieurs infirmiers, notamment quand il arrivait, par exemple, en Algérie. Il y avait des infirmiers européens qui avaient l'habitude d'être assez pépères dans leur racisme quotidien en tant qu'infirmier, en traitant des malades indigènes. Et lui ne supportait pas ça. Et c'est pour ça, d'ailleurs, qu'il a formé quelques infirmiers, notamment algériens de l'époque, un peu à ses méthodes pour les rendre un peu plus humains dans le travail. Donc voilà, souvent, ce qui ressort de lui, c'est ce côté humain. J'ai eu l'occasion de rencontrer une dame à Alger il y a 2 mois de ça, qui en fait, qui a été la voisine de Fanon. Donc son père était un ami de Fanon et ils partageaient le même palier. Et elle, qui était gamine à l'époque, me disait que un des rares souvenirs qu'elle avait de Fanon, c'était son rire. Et donc Fanon, qu'on voit souvent en image assez, de manière assez austère, qui sourit pas, qui a l'air très sérieux, mais qui en fait dans le quotidien, dans le privé, était quelqu'un qui apparemment aimait rire, aimait plaisanter. Mmh. Il était chaleureux. Voilà, donc je retiens aussi cette image de ce qui m'a été transmis par beaucoup de personnes que j'ai interviewées.
Mmh, ok. Et pour parler maintenant un peu plus de la pensée de Fanon, en tout cas la pensée qui s'est construite à travers justement ce parcours, on a pu voir au cours des dernières décennies, ou même de façon quasiment instantanée après les écrits de Fanon, que sa pensée a beaucoup été, ou en tout cas trop souvent, caricaturée. Parfois même détourné et même dénaturé en fait au gré des agendas de chacun. Et pour vous, des recherches que vous avez pu faire, ou en tout cas à la suite de ce documentaire que vous avez réalisé, quelle synthèse vous pourriez faire justement de la pensée de Fanon en lui rendant hommage justement au niveau de son combat et de ses idées qu'il a défendues toute sa vie?
Je pense que déjà, une des plus grosses caricatures qui a été faite de la pensée de Fanon, ça a été à chaque fois qu'on a parlé de la violence. À chaque fois qu'on a parlé de la violence de Fanon, on a très peu dit, ou alors souvent les ennemis de la pensée fanonienne, les ennemis de la liberté, je dirais, ont toujours essayé de mettre au centre la question de la violence pour discréditer le discours de Fanon. Mais sans expliquer que la violence qu'évoque Fanon, c'est pas une violence réactionnaire, c'est plutôt de l'autodéfense. Et quand on parle de la violence des peuples opprimés, on parle plus d'autodéfense. Et ça, on ne le dit jamais de la sorte. Et le fait de mettre au centre la violence, c'est évacuer l'origine de la violence pour pas vraiment débattre du vrai problème. Donc ça, c'est quelque chose qui a beaucoup été fait. Ensuite, oui, Fanon, quand on le lit, Fanon, c'est quelqu'un qui est à la recherche de quelque chose de nouveau, je le disais encore ce matin, moi, quand je lis Fanon, si je dois le résumer, c'est Fanon, c'est quelqu'un qui parle d'amour, et c'est quelqu'un qui, quelque part, essaye de mettre sa contribution pour aller vers la fin d'une décadence humaine, mmh. et d'essayer de remettre, de travailler dans le sens de remettre une humanité un petit peu sur des starting blocks nouveaux pour repartir sur quelque chose de plus juste, de plus équilibré, de plus égalitaire entre les hommes. Et donc sans vouloir, en se disant que le passé est là, mais voilà, on peut pas revenir dans le passé. Le passé, il a existé. Et puis maintenant, fantasmer certains éléments du passé, comme le font certains, c'est plus possible. Mais essayons de repartir plutôt sur quelque chose de nouveau.
Mmh. Le contexte dans lequel Fanon a émergé, ses idées, ses écrits, on a pu voir que aux quatre coins du globe, sa pensée a vraiment inspiré des mouvements politiques. Et en fait, quand on regarde votre documentaire, on se pose la question justement de cet héritage-là, de voir que par exemple, Les damnés de la Terre étaient vraiment un livre de chevet au niveau de la praxis politique des Black Panthers. On a pu voir aussi au Québec, par exemple, que le Front de libération du Québec était aussi inspiré par les idées de Fanon, de Césaire. Qu'en est-il aujourd'hui? On sent que Fanon est complètement évacué, ou en tout cas a gagné plutôt un terrain universitaire et moins terrain sur le plan politique. Comment vous expliquez ce changement de...
Comment dire? Moi, ce que je perçois de tout ça, c'est que déjà, Fanon parle de... Ses travaux sont intéressants parce que quand il traite beaucoup de la question de l'aliénation, notamment en tant que psychiatre, Et quand on parle de Fanon, on parle du colonialisme, mais pas que du colonialisme, on parle aussi de la question de la colonialité, c'est-à-dire du colonialisme de l'intérieur, la colonisation mentale, qui fait que, par exemple, quand on prend la question des Black Panthers ou d'autres mouvements ailleurs, on retrouve en fait un Fanon qui est utile pour travailler à se décoloniser l'esprit et se décoloniser mentalement, pour pouvoir justement être plus efficace, pour pouvoir vraiment lutter dans le sens de la libération pour tous. Et ça, on prend l'exemple aujourd'hui, on peut prendre le cas de pays qui n'auraient jamais été colonisés. Si on prend le cas d'aujourd'hui, je ne sais pas moi, d'un pays comme la Thaïlande ou comme un pays comme l'Éthiopie, qui est très peu colonisé, voire pas du tout, et ben en fait, Fanon peut être très présent. Pourquoi ? Parce que tout simplement, nous vivons dans un système global aujourd'hui qui fait qu'on a des normes, par exemple, eurocentrées qui sont actives partout, même dans des pays qui n'ont pas été colonisés. Et qui fait que sortir de ça, sortir de ces mécanismes, de ce colonialisme aussi de l'esprit, eh ben en fait, Fanon peut jouer un rôle. C'est peut-être la raison pour laquelle chez les Black Panthers, il a joué un grand rôle. Il n'y a pas que Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, il y a aussi Les Damnés de la Terre, qui est un livre très important, et qui va dans le même sens que Peau Noire, Masque Blanc, je dirais, avec peut-être 10 ans de plus de maturité, avec 10 ans d'expérience sur le terrain des luttes en Afrique. Mmh. Et voilà, et puis je pense que c'est la raison pour laquelle ça joue un grand rôle. Ensuite, pour la deuxième partie de la question, moi je pense qu'il y a une renaissance aujourd'hui de Fanon. Il revient, moi je le vois depuis le moment où j'ai commencé à travailler sur ce film, où personne parlait de Fanon, et puis, personne, hein, je ne veux pas être prétentieux, et dans certains milieux on parlait de Fanon, mais aujourd'hui Fanon revient. Et je sais qu'il y a d'autres projets de films qui sont en train de se faire. Il y a un projet de bande dessinée. Il y a des choses qui arrivent. Il y a des colloques qui sont sur Fanon qui n'étaient pas forcément très présents il y a quelques années de ça. Et c'est tant mieux, parce que ça montre que sa pensée est très pertinente et qu'elle est nécessaire aujourd'hui. Donc peut-être que l'idée de ce film aussi, c'est peut-être de le sortir aussi des griffes des universitaires. Parce que c'est très bien que Fanon soit étudié par les universitaires, mais Fanon peut être lu par tout le monde. Il faut que sa pensée se démocratise. On a très souvent véhiculé l'idée que c'était difficile de lire Fanon et que seuls les intellos lisaient Fanon, ce qui est faux. Tout le monde peut lire Fanon. Alors c'est vrai que moi, c'est vrai que j'ai lu Peau Noire, Masque Blanc la première fois, je l'ai lu avec un dico, parce qu'il y avait beaucoup de termes d'ordre de psychiatrie et des termes techniques qui me paraissaient incompréhensibles, et j'ai fait l'effort de le lire avec un dictionnaire, et finalement j'ai compris. Et je pense que tout le monde peut faire cet effort. Et puis Fanon, il n'est pas réservé aux universitaires, il n'est pas réservé aux professionnels de la pensée décoloniale aujourd'hui. Et que tout le monde, si on veut vraiment faire un vrai travail, Fanon, il peut être démocratisé. Je trouve très bien qu'il y ait une bande dessinée qui se fasse en ce moment, qui permette de...
Mais sur le plan de la pratique politique, est-ce que dans l'actualité internationale, vous voyez des populations, des peuples en lutte qui incarnent les idéaux de Fanon ?
Après, les idéaux de Fanon, c'est pas un prophète, dans le sens où ses livres, c'est vrai, on a tendance souvent à dire qu'un livre est une bible de quelque chose. Mais il peut s'insérer dans des luttes, c'est-à-dire que c'est pas le seul. On prend aujourd'hui, c'est vrai qu'il y a eu, on prend en Amérique du Sud, il y a eu pas mal de luttes où Fanon a joué un rôle dans les lectures de beaucoup de cadres. Il permet de se former politiquement. On parle par exemple même de la révolution iranienne. On sait qu'il y a beaucoup de cadres de la révolution iranienne qui ont lu Fanon. On voit par exemple des gens comme Ali Shariati, qui avait communiqué d'ailleurs avec Fanon, et d'autres. Je pense qu'aujourd'hui, il y a beaucoup de mouvements dits décoloniaux aux quatre coins du monde, même dans les métropoles du Nord, qui se développent, et pour qui Fanon est utile pour comprendre certains éléments, pour déconstruire aussi certains éléments liés aux dominations. Donc, dans ce sens-là, oui, il est utile, mais il faut justement, je pense qu'il faut le démocratiser, il faut cesser de le rendre inaccessible et de le montrer comme quelqu'un qui est juste, qui est entre les mains de certains, entre les griffes, je dirais plutôt, de certains professionnels fanoniens.
Ok. Et pour peut-être centrer un peu plus la discussion sur ce qui se passe dans l'actualité africaine, et notamment en Algérie ou dans d'autres pays, en fait, aux quatre coins du continent, il y a depuis un certain nombre d'années des mouvements populaires qui viennent finalement réhabiliter les demandes qui en fait sont intervenus pendant les guerres de libération, à savoir la dignité économique, la dignité politique, etc. Quel regard Fanon pourrait porter aujourd'hui sur ces luttes actuellement ? On ne peut pas parler à sa place, bien entendu, mais selon vous, d'après la lecture que vous en faites, qu'est-ce que vous pensez est-ce que ça s'inscrit dans une bonne direction, dans une bonne direction ?
Bah, pour parler, par exemple, de ce qui se passe en ce moment en Algérie, notamment, aujourd'hui, ce qui se passe en Algérie, il y a un air fanonien qui flotte dans l'air. C'est-à-dire qu'on voit aujourd'hui une génération qui a décidé d'accomplir sa mission. On a une nouvelle génération aujourd'hui qui est le fer de lance d'une révolte qui montre bien qu'elle a compris. On voit bien en ce moment dans les mots d'ordre qui sont utilisés. D'ailleurs, demain, on va le retrouver encore dans la manif qui aura lieu dans toute l'Algérie et pas seulement à Alger. On voit que c'est la continuité de la lutte d'indépendance qui est en train de se faire. Dans les mots d'ordre utilisés, on avait vu un panneau au début en disant, avec des caricatures, des dessins, où on voyait des gens dire « nous sommes en train de nettoyer les saletés que la France a laissées ». Ça veut dire quelque part que il y a un système néocolonial qui a pris place et on a envie de vraiment achever, réaliser cette lutte d'indépendance qui a été menée par nos aïeux de manière, je dirais, glorieuse et qui malheureusement a été récupérée par la suite ou a été détournée plutôt. Mmh. Et voilà. Et puis là, on sent qu'il y a une conscience populaire là-dessus. Et c'est pas un hasard si on voit des parents, et notamment des grands-parents, sortir des drapeaux algériens qui datent de 62, qui ont été brandis au moment de l'indépendance, et les sortir aujourd'hui. C'est-à-dire que derrière, il y a une symbolique avec cette jeunesse aujourd'hui qui a 20 ans, qui est le fer de lance de cette lutte intergénérationnelle, et qui est vraiment dans un esprit de lutte, de libération. Mmh. Et ça, je pense que c'est très fanonien, parce que on sent que cette jeunesse, elle a lu entre les lignes des discours officiels, des programmes officiels de l'école, et elle sait qui étaient les combattants réels de l'indépendance et qui a détourné aussi, qui ont été les fakes révolutionnaires qui sont arrivés après l'indépendance ou les révolutionnaires de la 25e heure. Mmh. Et donc, je pense que ça, c'est le cas. On parle de l'Algérie, mais on peut parler de ce qui se passe au Soudan en ce moment. Alors, c'est vrai que dans les médias, on en parle un peu moins, notamment dans le contexte français. Ce qui se passe au Soudan, c'est très important aussi. Ce qui se passe, on le voit aujourd'hui en Afrique de l'Ouest. On voit au Mali, ça bouge beaucoup. On voit la société civile au Niger aussi qui bouge beaucoup et qui est aussi réprimée. On le voit en ce moment, des mouvements comme au Sénégal qui se lèvent aussi, avec France Dégage, au Burkina Faso, c'est qu'il y a un ras-le-bol. Il y a une génération aujourd'hui qui a envie de se prendre en main et qui a compris aussi que leur salut serait dû à leur mobilisation. Et ça, c'est très important aujourd'hui. Et on voit que des personnages comme Sankara, notamment quand on prend le cas du Burkina Faso, et pas qu'au Burkina Faso, revient énormément. C'est-à-dire que le discours de souveraineté de Sankara, son discours sur la dette, ce sont des éléments que la jeunesse connaît. Et puis, il se le réapproprie et puis essaye d'en faire un outil politique aujourd'hui pour se mobiliser, essayer de se débarrasser de ses pouvoirs et de ces petits intermédiaires du colonialisme qui sont en place, ces petites castes qui en profitent, ces petites bourgeoisies compradores. Mmh. Et puis derrière, on sait qu'il y a toujours une contre-révolution qui est menée à partir de cellules de l'Élysée et d'ailleurs. Mmh. Et ça,
Tout à fait.
Mais il faut y faire face.
Exactement. Et pour terminer, Hassan Mezine, je sais que dans le cadre de votre tournée pour présenter votre film, vous avez eu beaucoup de rencontres ou en tout cas de discussions avec votre public. Et j'aurais voulu savoir quelles sont les réactions justement que vous avez reçues de la part de ces différents publics. Est-ce qu'il y a parmi la nouvelle génération des personnes qui ont découvert Fanon grâce à votre film ?
Alors, je pense que oui. Dans le sens où je pense que les gens ont surtout découvert pour ce qu'il est vraiment. C'est-à-dire que j'ai eu l'occasion de présenter le film dans plusieurs endroits, dont par exemple en Martinique, en Algérie. Et les publics, à la fin, souvent les réactions ont été on connaissait un peu Fanon, ou on pensait savoir qui il était, mais on ne savait pas qu'il avait fait tout ça. Et on ne savait pas qu'il était à ce point-là aujourd'hui utile, notamment pour beaucoup de personnes. Et on le voit dans le film, ceux qui le verront, on voit qu'il y a un tour d'horizon de personnages aujourd'hui qui parle de Fanon d'une certaine manière. Et donc, surtout, ce qui a été très plaisant, et notamment chez les jeunes, c'est de susciter l'envie de faire découvrir Fanon, de le lire. Et c'est ce qui est ressorti souvent. Beaucoup de jeunes ont dit « Ah, j'ai vraiment envie de le lire, je savais comme ça ce qu'il était, mais maintenant j'ai vraiment envie de le lire, de le découvrir. » Et ça, c'est, oui, je crois que c'est un des points très positifs qui fait que je suis, moi je suis assez content d'avoir fait ce film rien que pour ça, quoi. Quand un jeune dit qu'il a envie de lire Fanon et que ça l'intéresse et qu'il est motivé.
Mission accomplie.
Bah, c'est déjà, oui, quelque part mission accomplie, et ça a été le cas dans plusieurs endroits, et puis et même en France. Donc voilà, donc je pense que ce film, s'il peut avoir une petite vocation à servir d'éducation populaire et de faire découvrir un personnage Fanon qui permettra de découvrir aussi d'autres personnes qui ont lutté pour l'indépendance et pour la souveraineté des pays du Sud, je pense que c'est positif.
Ben, merci infiniment Hassan Mezine. Je rappelle à nos auditeurs et auditrices que vous êtes le réalisateur de Fanon hier et aujourd'hui, un documentaire qui sera diffusé en première canadienne le mardi 21 mai 2019 à 18h30 à l'espace Osgang Plaza au 6524 rue Saint-Hubert à Montréal, événement co-organisé par le collectif Pour une dignité politique et Lecture radicale Montréal. Nous mettrons toutes ces informations sur notre page Facebook et sur notre blog. Donc merci d'avoir écouté cette émission et restez branchés sur CKUT 90.3 FM. Do you know social living is the best? 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 Takes behavior to get along. Lots of behavior to get along. Do you really, really know that? Do you know social living is the best? Do you know social living is the best? Social living is the best. Do you know social living is the best? Soca in your 514.
Are you a DJ? Do you love soca music? Production Sounds is giving all Montreal DJs an opportunity to showcase their talent on CKUT 90.3 FM. All you gotta do is submit a one-hour soca mix to be aired on Soca Sessions late Friday nights. Simply email your one-hour mix as soon as possible to productionsounds@gmail.com.
Listen me, Production Sounds, Production Sounds.
Crazy people.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it this week for Amandla here at CQT 90.3. These have been rebroadcast from previous editions of Amandla. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
Africa!
I'm Alice, and I'm here playing Super Mario. And you are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
We'd like you to welcome Mr. Leon Thomas.
I came to this town, was tired of moving around. I came to get straight, I had to get straight, no time to waste. God knows I had to make haste. Good things are moving, no time for doodling. I used to wonder how, when everything seemed profound, I'm feeling late, I had to get straight. Get straight enough time, no time for chasing around. I'm trying to keep up, I've got to keep up. You wanna know why? Because they're waiting in line. I'm in a hurry, no time to worry. You see, to me, it really matters what comes, it really doesn't, so I'm chasing it straight. Do you know who did it?